And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO with Martin Willis and Michael Lauck. Please remember to visit the website, podcastufo.com. Check out the latest blogs and forums. And while you're there, don't forget to like our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Michael Lauck is out sick. He has lost his voice. I asked him if he could do sign language. We could capture it on Skype, but he will not be joining us for the news this week. And next week, I will be traveling across the country, so I will not be able to record news with him. We will still have a show that will be with Stanton Friedman, always a fun guest to have on. I'm not sure what the first part of the show is going to be. Today's podcast is number 68 with Steve Pierce. Steve was one of the witnesses that was in the truck during the Travis Walton case back in 1975. I'll be speaking with him at a conference, so please excuse the background noise. Well, lately there's a lot of buzz going around about the recent discovery of slides that allegedly came from Roswell back in 1947. You'll see it plastered all over the internet. I'm going to read an excerpt here from Before It's News. The truth, in the past few months, the rumors have swirled that members of the Roswell investigation team had become aware of two photographic slides depicting an alien humanoid creature. This is true, and it is equally true that they may represent the first genuine physical evidence in support of reality of the crash of extraterrestrial beings near Roswell, New Mexico, over six decades ago. The stunning historic photographs have been confirmed to have been imaged on two Kodachrome slides dating from the year 1947, the year of the UFO crash. There is no indication of retouching, digital enhancement, or other photographic hoax technique. They are clear, in color, up close, and taken from two separate angles. These slides were found hidden in an attic in a chest having belonged to a deceased couple. The author made the incredible discovery that the husband was a very prominent petroleum geologist who conducted oil exploration expeditions in the 1940s in West Texas and in New Mexico. This area also encompassed the Permian Basin, an area that includes Roswell, New Mexico. Rather than depicting the popular culture image of aliens in the 1940s, they show the image of a small humanoid alien, like those aliens described by witnesses to Roswell. I have longtime Roswell investigator Don Schmidt on Skype now. And Don, what do you say about all this?
Well, wouldn't it be wonderful if such a story was true? And even then, 50% of the people would still discount it. It's just in their nature that I find people that tend to be skeptical on the subject that the more facts, the more truth you present them, the more documentation, the more evidence, the more they entrench themselves to, even disbelieve all the more ardently. Mm-hmm. I also find it amusing that, you know, the total hypocrisy of the very debunkers who have never given us the time of day, who now assign themselves as though they're part of the UFO community and that we owe them anything. That, you know, for all of the attempts on our part to establish what did happen back in 1947, no one has investigated the alternative explanations more than we have. Mm-hmm. No one has ever been there offering to help as far as any of these rumor mongers when it came to tracking down all the witnesses, whether it was Kevin Randall or Tom Carey and other members of our team, as far as traveling to close to 40 states around the country at our own expense. We've had three archaeological digs at the debris field. We're in the process of conducting a fourth, again, at our own expense. Wow. And where have these people been all along? And yet when we attempt to perform due diligence in establishing whether something is genuine, I hearken back to what I personally experienced with the MJ-12 documents. I was then on the board of directors at the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, and I received a phone call from one of my fellow board members about these documents. Sight unseen, I was asked to go to Paul Harvey, the late ABC news commentator, because after Dr. Hynek had passed away, I was the one who then was selected to brief him on a regular basis regarding the subject of UFOs. So, Don, you know Paul Harvey. You have to, you know, get these documents to him. Well, I haven't seen these documents. Well, you know, they look good. They look good. Well, who are they from? Well, they look good. And it cost me my friendship with Paul Harvey. Huh. And it's another example of where it's either a case of investigative malpractice on the part of individuals who rush a judgment as much as it is those who are clamoring for evidence to be presented for no other reason, no other purpose than to attack it, than to destroy it. And that's why I find it all the more hypocritical that the very people who are spreading all the rumors are the first ones to say that no such evidence could even exist. That if it were genuine, it has to be a fake. It has to be hoaxed. It can't be accepted as reliable because there are no such things. UFOs don't exist. The double standard here. But as I mentioned, Martin, we're having another dig. Mm-hmm. And if any of these people, you know, would like to join us, you know, actually come out and actually get away from their blogs, their computers, leave their house once in a while. You know, get their hands dirty. But I'll guarantee you, if you come out and help us, you're going to have blisters, you're going to be sunburned, you're going to be exhausted at the end of each day. But you're going to feel like you finally contributed something in the search for the truth. I have little respect and little patience for people than for no other reason than their own self-serving agendas, who try to force us into playing our hands before we're ready, before we have disclosed something and we are confident that beyond a shadow of a doubt that we have performed all due diligence. And then as a result, we present it not to the UFO community, we go to the media, we go to the public. Because it's a subject, as you know, Martin, we're walking on eggshells. It's such a taboo topic on the face of it. It's kryptonite to the media, to the scientific community. And, you know, what good, if there's any chance, if such slides do in fact exist, and they do potentially provide genuine proof, you know, once and for all. First of all, no such photographs ever prove anything. By today's standards, anything can be doctored, anything can be faked. So all the more reason, one has to be all the more cautious.
Sure.
But say it truly depicts something of this extraordinary nature. There's a lot to lose, but there's so much more to gain in dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's, and just making sure that we don't have a repeat of what happened with the MJ-12 documents or all the other photographs that have circulated through the years and have turned out to be bogus. Why would any of the members of my team want to be party to another such fiasco? And I can assure you, Martin, the people that are again creating the fiasco and spreading the rumors are not part of the team, are not the ones who are spending the money, making all the trips, as far as conducting all the research. They're just those that are just waiting to play gotcha. Right. That we once again, you know, we rushed the gun. We didn't prove beyond a shadow of a doubt we were dealing with something authentic. And as a result, You know, we're a bunch of bumbling idiots once again, stumbling around in the dark. And I'm not going to have any part of that again.
Now, if you could be talking directly to the person that is coming forward claiming they have these slides in hand, what advice would you give them?
Well, first of all, not go to the UFO community.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I would honestly suggest that they do not contact the media, that they themselves would perform all of the necessary testing, check out as far as with photo labs, with as far as Eastman Kodak, for example, make sure that the images are again dated, that it can be established that they are of that time era. We have never, and I can't think of anybody as far as on the team, have suggested that if such slides or such images, such photographs, such it was even suggested at one time this was a diary, you know, with a personal log of what transpired back in 47. We have never suggested that this has anything to do with Roswell. We don't use the word when it comes to such evidence. No different than during our archaeological work, should we find something? Because how do you establish, how do you draw the connection unless you're there at the time of the incident? You can infer that it is.
Mm-hmm.
And unless it's actually something that is stamped, you know, UFO 1947 or Roswell incident, you know, and you certainly, Martin, you remember the alien autopsy film.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And how quickly they tried to ride on our coattails by suggesting that it was from Roswell, that the body being autopsied was from Roswell. Well, we were the ones who immediately put our feet down and said, you know, you cease and desist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless it states beyond a shadow of a doubt and there is documentation to that effect that this indeed does involve the recovery at Roswell, we wish you would stop. We want you to stop. We demand that you stop. And they did. And they changed the date. They moved it up a month, claimed it was from another incident.
Wow.
As you see, the media continues to still call it the Roswell alien autopsy.
Yeah, it just kind of muddies it even more. Now, I know that there was rumors circulating around that Kevin Randall had some input about this, and then I saw a statement that he said, no, he has nothing to do with this.
And we have intentionally, you know, kept quiet for the fact that we don't have all the information.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have access to all the data. It's still very fluid. It's still something that we haven't shared and we haven't discussed openly, even between ourselves, because the people that are in direct possession of any such evidence, we have allowed them to make every effort to verify and authenticate such evidence, should it exist, and with our cooperation and with our input, with our involvement, we have also made efforts toward authentication. And as a result, it's going to be drawn out. I'm sorry. The legitimate people in this field realize that photographs and videos and documents, as we were discussing earlier with MJ-12, unless you can establish the pedigree, you're left with establishing the authenticity of the evidence itself. And as a result, we don't have a chain of transference. We can't plug as far as this chain of evidence from A to B to C. We're left with a dangling Chad, so to speak, you know, from a voting ballot without a name on it. And we're trying to establish now which way does the Chad, who is it actually, you know, voting for? Who's it actually indicating? So please respect, and I ask everyone, please, it's going to take time, and that's all, you know, that anything of this nature, it still comes down to.
Right. So just getting back to the dig you have coming up, you sort of indicated that, you know, people could come out and help. If someone's actually serious and wants to actually help with this, how would they reach you? How would they get in touch with you?
Well, certainly at the website, www.roswellinvestigator.com, and we have contact information there. With the upcoming project, we're obviously fully staffed. We have three archaeologists, a geologist, leading four separate teams, and we are not in any need of any help for this particular one, but we are already planning a fifth, potentially into next year. So then if that be the case, they certainly could become, you know, a part of that project, because it still comes down to, you know, we're constantly accused of being in this for the money. Well, I'd like to break even someday.
Yeah.
I mean, Kevin Randall could verify this. I mean, for the first couple of years of the investigation, our phone bills between the two of us were averaging $1,000 a month.
Yeah, back when because phone bills were expensive, right?
You didn't. That's right. And we didn't have the internet, and we had to literally, we had to track down people. And to suggest that after all this time, it's become a cottage industry, and we're just continuing to draw this out because we're dangling this carrot. Again, we didn't dangle the carrot. It's no different than as we have made every effort to establish the veracity of any documentation, any eyewitness testimony, that you open yourself up to such scrutiny just for the fact that you have to do certain things in public. Mm-hmm. You have to submit Freedom of Information Act requests. You'll go to corporations trying to demonstrate the authenticity of documents, photographs, and you'll seek out witnesses. You'll go to a town, you'll go into a city, and you'll start hunting around and asking questions. And unfortunately, as quickly as things get on the internet, well, things spill out, and it creates all types of rumors and speculation. And at least what I'd like to do and what I believe I've done, let's dispense with the rumors. Let's allow this to play out and then allow whatever evidence eventually comes out to stand on its own merit. It shouldn't involve who presented it, who owned it, who researched it. I mean, it will stand on its own merit. It's no different than if the town drunk should happen to come up with a piece of physical debris of a flying saucer. Does it matter if it who it came from? It, again, it will speak for itself.
That's right. It's funny you mentioned that. I was talking to a guy that researched and discovered an unknown Da Vinci painting, and he basically said exactly the same thing. He said it doesn't matter if it belongs to the town drunk, a thief, or anyone. It stands on its own.
That's right.
I love the parallel there. Hey, thanks so much, Don. I really appreciate
Martin,
it.
We will keep you informed and yes, stay with me as well. And I appreciate, because you're at least one of the legitimate people who has contacted us just requesting our side of it.
Yeah, well,
and we appreciate that, because the rest are just, you know, stirring up the BS.
That's right. All right, thanks again, Don. And coming up in a few minutes is Steve Pearce. Enjoy this tune by Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse.
Thank you.
All right, I'm with Steve Pierce. How you doing, Steve?
Pretty good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We're going to talk about your book in a moment here, but still, just to refresh the listener's mind here about who you are. You were one of the witnesses that was with Travis Walton back November 5th, 1975, when that whole event happened. And you were the youngest one of the, was there seven people total?
Yeah, there was three in the front seat and four in the back seat.
So you were the youngest at mm-hmm. that time. 17, you lied about your age.
Yeah, get the job. Yeah.
And, you know, I can remember what I was like at that young age. Very impressionable, kind of scared about different things. What on earth did you, what on earth were you thinking when you came around that corner, first of all, in the truck, and saw that craft just sitting there? I mean, what went through your mind?
I thought, at first, you know, when you first thought it's beautiful. I mean, it was the prettiest thing you ever seen. It was
really,
you just looked at it and it was like, you're, wow, man, is this really what we're seeing here? You know? And then when Travis got out and got zapped, it went into, like, you know, terror, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we were all scared to death. I thought the world was coming to an end. And
you know, I've heard other people say that about events. They think the world is coming to an end when they see things like that happen. So were you, it was complete panic in the truck and go, go, go? And
Well, when the spaceship started rocking back and forth, it started going beep, 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 and this loud, pitchy noise came out, and this bluish-green light came out and zapped Travis, and he hits the ground. I see him hit the ground. As soon as I said it, he hits the ground. I said, they got him. And as soon as I hauled out, they got him. Mike Rogers was driving. He takes off, and you know, he leaves him. And we go about a quarter of a mile down. We go to the main dirt road. I mean, we're hauling for a minute, and Mike keeps saying, look back. I don't think anybody was looking back because the truck was bouncing too much because it was going too fast on this log road, you know. And so we stopped and we seen it take off. So we saw it take off, and then everybody's hollering at each other. I ain't saying nothing. I never said much for a long time after that. And they're arguing and let's go get the cops or let's go get help or just go do something, you know. And Kenny Peterson says, you know, we have to go back. We have to go look for him. We can't, you know.
Now, who was the one who thought he was incinerated?
One of the guys jumped out of the truck and said he was incinerated. And I said, no. I seen him hit the ground. I know his body's there.
Oh, you're the one that said you saw him hit the ground.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I saw the whole thing. I seen him hit the ground because I'm the closest one to it.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm next to the window. Alan Dallas hits the floorboard, and so he's standing on the floorboard like this, and I'm right like this. And then Kenny Peterson's in the front seat right there.
Yeah.
And then Mike's over on the driver's side. And then Kenny, John Goulette, and Alan, Dwayne Smith, they're behind me.
Yeah.
So I'm the closest to the door, and I don't think everybody's seen him get hit the ground.
Really? Yeah.
Because you know you seen him hit the ground. I seen him hit the ground, and he bounced back up and hit the ground, and that's when I said they got him. That's when Mike took off.
Now, did your instant thought was that he was dead?
I thought he was dead.
Yeah.
I thought he was dead for 5 days. That's the reason the next day that when they got that posse and. To go look for him, I got out the back door and hid all day, and I went into hiding because I thought I was going to go out there and find a body.
And then you would be blamed for it somehow?
Yeah.
So you're 17 years old. You wouldn't really be tried as an adult, or you may have at that time.
In Arizona, I think you could be tried as an adult. And the cops even told me, 2 days after this happened, they still ain't found Travis, and I'm hiding and going back through the back ways and stuff, and this cop named Flake, the city cop, he catches me and puts me in the back of the cop car, and he was telling me, you know, we know you didn't kill Travis.
But who did?
But we know, you know who did.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And for the, we just don't understand why you're keeping this such a big secret, you know? Because mm-hmm. in the state of Arizona, we don't need a body to convict you. And also, in the state of Arizona, if you're with that person that does that crime, you're just as guilty as the person who did the crime. So
they were trying to break you, basically.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's the reason they took me the first one, the polygraph test. They figured I would crack under the pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. And that whole polygraph test thing is totally amazing. That everyone passed except Dallas, who was inconclusive at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But later,
because he got mad. Yeah, he passed it in 93.
Yeah.
He just got mad because they asked me if you killed Travis, and what do you ask me questions like this for? And just ripped everything off.
Yeah. I want to talk about what was it like for you when you got home that evening and you actually talked to your mother. You're living with your mother.
Yeah.
What did you say to her? And how, did she not believe you?
I took her to the bathroom because I have four little brothers.
Yeah.
And I didn't want them to hear, so I took her in the bathroom, and because we lived in this apartment, and told her what happened. And I don't think she really believed it at first. She thought maybe it was some kind of a joke or something, you know. Until the next morning, when the news reporters and the cops and were coming to the door, and that's when it hit reality. You know, something's going on. And the first day, when I took off and hid all day, I hid at a girlfriend's house, and her mother came home, and I'm hiding in her bedroom, and I can hear them talking, and she's telling her daughter, you got to stay away from that Steve Pierce boy, because the whole town thinks that all them boys killed Travis, and his body's out in that woods somewhere.
Now, this is a fairly small town at the time.
Yeah.
And about how many people? A couple thousand?
A couple thousand.
Yeah. So everybody basically knew everybody, and this got around pretty fast.
Yeah, it got around really quick.
Yeah. If we backtrack just a little bit, when you guys were heading in the truck and you're going to the diner or the bar or wherever it was, were you at one point trying to say, let's not say anything?
What diner, what bar?
Oh, I'm sorry, it was in...
That's not true.
Oh, okay.
Okay, when we came down the hill, after we looked for Travis, we couldn't find him.
Yeah.
We came off the hill, and the first phone booth is still there, too. The first phone booth we came hit when we hit the pavement was a phone substation. It's a building. It's a substation, but, you know, it's not an office building, but it's a, you know.
Yep.
And there was two phones there, and that's where Kenny Peterson made the phone call. And Mike was really upset when it happened, so he was still upset the time he came down the hill, so Kenny called.
Yeah.
And Kenny called him and told him about a missing person. He didn't say nothing about, you know, a UFO or anything. And then we drove from there into town a little bit, three blocks, to the main drag, so we met the cops at a gas station.
I see.
And when there was like three showed up, and... it was a town Heber sheriff, cop, police officer, whatever. And then Gillespie's assistant showed up, and Sheriff Gillespie showed up later. And then Gillespie was telling him, you know, that Mike has to go back, and two other guys have to go back. So Kenny Peterson and Alan Dallas went back. Me, John Gillette, and Dwayne Smith went back to Snowflake.
And so you were separated for a while, all you guys were, is that what you're saying?
That night?
Oh, that was just that night.
Yeah, it was just that night.
I see, yep. And were you there when the first search was going on, or did you?
No, I was hiding.
Oh, that's when you started hiding.
Yeah, that's when I snuck out the back door, and
while
they were out there searching. And John told me that everyone had a cop next to him. And the cops were telling, you guys might as well just confess, you know. Yeah.
And so there's a huge amount of pressure on you to confess.
Well, I thought Travis was dead. You think I'm going to go out there with 100 cops and they find a body?
Yeah.
We'd never get away.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're talking Arizona. Arizona, you're guilty until you're proven innocent.
Was there going to be another story you were going to tell, or were you always going to tell about the UFO?
Yeah, Kenny Peterson is a religious person.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have lied.
Yeah.
And I don't think John Gillette would have lied either. I think me and Alan Dallas and Dwayne Smith, I think we all would have came up with a different.
Now, and all the accounts that I've ever seen, like, nobody believes you. But were there people that actually stood by you and believed what you were saying?
Either I had people that tell me they didn't believe me, or some people would never answer me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Instead of to keep friends, they wouldn't bring it up. They wouldn't argue about it. And you know.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know very many people that I'm related to that believes it back then.
Yeah.
Since I came out and started talking about it, I've got all kinds of people who jumped on the bandwagon.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now they're so we always believed, but
yeah,
now I know who believed and who didn't back then.
Now I want to talk about the time when you were offered some money to come forward and say that the whole thing was a hoax.
Well, after this happened, I got married to another girl who was old enough to buy me beer.
Were you still 17?
Well, I just turned 18, and back then you had to be 19 to buy beer, so I was still not old enough to buy beer.
Yeah.
And well, we moved to Taylor, and that's a town next to Snowflake. And one day we lived on a dirt road, and one day a city cop, a Taylor cop, came to the door. He's going down the dirt road, and we can hear him coming. And my ex-wife goes, Jim Click's coming down the road. What'd you do this time? You know, she thought I was in trouble again.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes to the door and he tells me, he says, Philip Glass said he'd give you $10,000 if you say it was a hoax. Well, at the time, I just blew it off. I just thought he was another news reporter. You know, I didn't know who Philip Glass really was until 2009 when me and Travis started talking again.
So now this is, you and Travis weren't talking for a while?
35 years. We never said a word to each other.
Now that was, so you're talking about this is 1980-ish or close to that, when you were offered this money, and that was...
Okay, it started in 75.
Yeah.
And I was leaving and went back to Texas, because that's where my mom's family's all from. And I went back to Texas and didn't talk about it to my mom's relatives out there, because they didn't believe it anyway, because they're all Baptist. And I'm raised half Pentecostal and half Southern Baptist, so... My dad's side's Pentecostal, my mom's side's Southern Baptist. And that's another reason I thought it was from the devil, because the way I was brought up, you know, because I was only 17, and you only know what your parents...
You're impressionable, yeah.
Yeah, you only know what your parents have taught you,
mm-hmm.
you know, about religion and stuff, so you go by what, you know, your parents have taught you. And at first I thought it was from the devil, but I don't believe this has anything to do with one, has nothing to do with the other. You got these people out here believing, this is all from the devil. You know, this is all in the Bible. I have never read. I disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I don't believe one has to do with the other.
Yeah. So getting back to when he offered you the money, how could you possibly turn that down? That was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. And when I moved to Texas, he found out that I lived in Texas, and he started calling me in Texas, saying, I'll give you this money if you say it's a hoax. And one time he gets off the phone, and I tell my ex-wife, I says, I'm just going to take this money. Nobody believes us anyway. You know, everybody still thinks we're making all this up, so might as well take the money. And we're talking 70s, you know, $10,000 back then, you know.
Huge. You could buy a house almost.
Yeah. So the next time he called, I told him, I says, okay. And Philip Glass is the only one I ever said it was a hoax to. But I had to say it to him to get the money. Mm-hmm. And some way you're going to get the money is to say it. So I told him, okay, what do I do now? So he flew to Texas, and we met at a restaurant. And he told me I need to go back to Arizona and find a generator or something. And I told him, man, you're going to need a big generator. This white got brighter and brighter and brighter, and you're going to need maybe about two or three big ones. He just looks at me. Because he knew I was only saying it for the money.
Yeah.
You know, he flat out knew that the only reason I'm saying this is I want the money. And that's what I kept saying to him. I want the money. How do I get the money?
Mm-hmm.
So he left, and I go back home, and a couple nights later I was... talking to my ex-wife and telling her what I did because she didn't want me to meet him anyway. Mm-hmm. And she tells me, she says, "You really believe this happened?" And I says, "Yeah, you know I do." "So you're going to sell yourself out because you're mad at Mike and you're mad at Mike and Travis, you know, because that was the main reason I was doing it too, just to piss them off." Mm-hmm. And she says, "Well, I'm not going to spend the money if you do this." So I started avoiding him again. You know, she was right. I shouldn't sell myself out this for her. Yeah. And she told me, "Your day will come," you know.
Yeah.
And so I started avoiding him again, and we moved to Utah. And I got a phone call the where I worked, and they asked to talk to me. I didn't answer the phone, so I don't know if this is Philip Glass or not, but he said, "I want to talk to me about an incident happened in Arizona." Well, it had to be him, you know. Mm-hmm. So then we moved to back to Arizona, and I got divorced, and I was living with my brother and his wife, and Philip Glass started calling them. I don't know how they found his number.
Hmm.
You know, but they started calling her and telling her, "I tell him I give him the money, I give him the money." And then after that, this is like 3 years went by, maybe four, and I just took off from Arizona altogether.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Started a new life somewhere else.
Yeah. Then you were a truck driver for a long time.
Yeah, I went over the road. That's what I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I couldn't stay in one place very long.
Yeah. Now, how would you say that this whole thing has affected your life in a nutshell?
You know, people's asked me that before, but this has been my life.
Yeah.
It happened at me in an early age.
Such a young age. Yeah.
You know, it's been my whole life.
Yeah. Now, have you tried to put it away for a while? And
I tried to do that a couple times. I thought I almost had it in... 10 years from the date I saw Travis get zapped, I saw four of them, and they came to me, and I was out in the middle of nowhere, riding trains and being a bum, and I stayed drunk a lot, and they came to me, and I talked to them, and that's when I sobered up and went to Mississippi and started driving truck.
Ah, wow.
And then after that, I seen him a few years after that. It's in my book.
Yeah, let's talk about your book.
About Yvonne Smith hypnotizing me and mm-hmm. doing the regression. I did five of them. I'm not going to do no more. Five's enough. She's got enough. Mm-hmm. Enough stuff came out because it wears me out.
Yeah.
And then it kind of freaks me out for a few days because you don't remember everything. And then when you watch it, you're, whoa, you know.
Reliving is very painful.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the name of your book?
Broken Silence, One Man's Journey.
And you said this is going to be republished now.
Yes.
Is it available to anyone now, or is it?
Well, I've got a few books with me that after that, you're going to have to wait a couple months. It's going to be out on everywhere. You can get it through the book, you know, on the internet and stuff.
By the same title.
Yeah,
same
I'm
title.
Keeping the same title and the same cover, but I'm just got a publisher and a writer who's going to redo the whole thing. And, you know, the book I have now, me and my ex-wife, we put it together, and we got an artist to draw the pictures for us and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then we went to a printer to print the book out. The books are nice, but it's just written by me talking.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, I'm looking forward to read it. I bought one of your books. You gave me a nice discount.
Well, I misspelled a couple words.
Hey, that's fine. Yeah. Well, no, it'll be great to read what I would call the raw, you know, the raw version of you pouring your heart out. So I'm really excited to read it. So now we talked about things up to this date. What do you think the future is going to be of this whole case? I mean, it's one of the most believable cases out there.
In 93, I was in a truck stop getting fuel, and I went and paid for my fuel, and then I went to the restroom, and on the way out, I went through the TV room, and there was Travis Walton on HBO talking about Fire in the Sky.
Wow.
And that's how I knew they made a movie.
Really? That's how you found out?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. At 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, he's on HBO talking about fire in the sky, and I'm, whoa, man. That kept me awake. I was going to New Orleans. I was a day and a half early for my load. But I never knew it really got this big. I didn't even know they even had UFO conferences until 2011.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I stayed away from it all. Yeah. I drove truck and I stayed out there and I never watched the movie Fire in the Sky until 2008, 2009. I finally sat down and watched it with my daughter and my ex-wife and my daughter was saying, you know, I said, Henry Thomas, that's me. Well, why'd they change your name? Mm-hmm. I said, I don't know, but that's me. Yeah. She goes, well, prove it. So I got a hold of Travis, and Travis sent her a book and a poster and autographed everything. And so she was her idea. You need to get out and start talking about this, telling people.
Yeah.
And then I was going to get out of it in 2012,
yes,
February.
Yes, I heard that.
Because yeah. Robert Shaper, I think I got his name right. Well, he got up and called me a liar about Philip Klass offering me that money. He says, mm-hmm. You're lying. You're making all this up. Well, I don't need that.
Yeah.
You don't believe me? You know, I'm not going to get up and argue with people. And I almost came off the stage to knock his little ass out. But I got so many emails.
Yeah.
So many people.
Support.
For support, you know, they put it on Open Minds. There's two videos. The first one by Open Minds that show me, you know, tell me I'm gonna get out of this.
Yeah.
And they did another one showing all these people send me emails and messages and stuff and tell me to keep talking about it. But Robert Shaver even wrote an article about me. It's on, if you look up my name, Steve Pierce, Fire in the Sky, on the internet, you can find his article in there too, because everything comes in my name, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But his facts are wrong. Travis's first book came out in 77?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, in his first book, he mentions that about the money that Philip Klass offered me. Philip Klass was alive and kicking.
Right.
When the first book came out.
Mm-hmm.
And if Travis would have wrote something in a book that way they didn't like each other, and if it wasn't true, if Philip Klass would have came in charging.
You would think so.
You know he
would
have.
Libel or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if this wasn't true, why didn't he say anything when he was alive?
Right.
You know? Yeah. And also, I can prove the cop came to my door. I have a police officer named Jim Click that lives in Taylor, Arizona, you know,
mm-hmm.
that came to the door.
Yep.
You know, he's the one who gave the message. Well, if I'm lying, how come I got all this, you know? I have enough proof that he actually all offered me this money, you know, and he thinks I don't. He thinks I'm making it all up.
And why would someone make that up? Really? It doesn't make sense.
And another thing, when this first happened, Mike Rogers found out that, and I don't know how Mike found out, that he found out that Philip Klass offered me the money, and he even said in public that if Steve takes that money, he's not going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Wow.
Threatened to kick my ass.
Yeah.
I don't think he could have done it. But
Now, have you spoke with the other people that was involved in that? Mike Rogers, for instance. Have you?
I haven't seen Mike Rogers since about 3-4 months after that happened.
Really? Wow.
I've seen John Gillette. I talk to him all the time, and I haven't seen Kenny Peterson, Dwayne Smith. And the last time I seen Alan Dallas passed away.
I heard that, yeah.
We were in jail together
about
2-3 years after this happened.
Really?
Yeah. That's the reason I left Arizona, man.
Yeah.
It just got way too crazy.
Yeah.
And we sat there and we talked about this all one night while we were in jail together. And it's in my book, why I went to jail and everything. Don't worry, it's nothing.
Yeah,
he's being.
Well, you're a free man now.
Hey, yeah, I have moved in Arizona for 35 years, and I haven't been in no trouble.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's great.
It's. Yeah. I get paranoid when I go there. I want somebody else to drive.
Don't blame you.
Well, they know I'm in town.
Yeah. Well, Steve, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It was nice meeting you.
Yes. And again, the name of your book one more time.
Broken Silence, One Man's Journey. My email is steve.pierce@hotmail.com, steve.pierce@hotmail.com. And thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our show, and please remember to check out our website, podcastufo.com, for the latest blogs and forums. We will be back next week. Thanks again, and remember, keep your eyes to the sky.